We started last week into the topic of eschatology, the final of the major loci of theology, and so tonight we continue with that discussion. You remember, by way of review, that we defined what eschatology is. It is based on the Greek word eschaton, which means what? Eschaton means, it's an adjective meaning last. Okay, and it's used as an adjective in front of words like the last day or the last hour or the last time, those sorts of things. In other words, time-based type of words. So this word eschaton is where we get our word eschatology. And when we talk about eschatology, we mean the theological discussion of all that is necessary for the divine decree of God to be accomplished in time and space. Now, when we talk about eschatology, we're not just talking about that which will be. We're talking about all that must be in order for God's divine decree to take place. So eschatology, in a sense, is not just about what is yet to come, but all that was necessary for the plan of God to come into play. So there's an eschatological element to everything that happens. The death of Christ on the cross was an eschatological event. It ushered in a salvation. The work of creation was an eschatological event. That particular event, creation, will be bookended by a time in the future when Christ will come and establish his kingdom. So all things have an eschatological reality to them. Now, when we think of eschatology, we typically think of some future time in which everything is resolved and so forth. But that's a poor man's definition of eschatology. To understand eschatology, we need to understand the entire framework of time and space as God is attempting to accomplish his purposes in all things. By the way, when I say attempting, I don't mean that it's a possibility of failure. I just mean he is accomplishing it, okay? So eschatology is certainly about things yet to be, but in reality, all of creation, all of time and space is eschatological in its framework. We talked about eschatology in terms of its reality in human history. Human beings are inherently subject to eschatology. We recognize that everything that has a beginning must have an end. And so therefore, even outside of religion, there's an eschatological sense in humanity, and it's certainly the primary question of religion. How will everything be consummated in the end? What is the goal of all that there is? That's fundamental to every religious system in the world. And then we spent some time talking about eschatology as it has been understood through the ages, through the church itself, through church history. In the medieval period, during the days of the Reformation, in the early church, and now in the modern church, how has eschatology been understood? And I left you last week with this thought. There are actually two distinct branches of eschatology that we must discuss. If we're going to do a thorough understanding of this topic, we must understand both branches of it. Now, one of those branches is what we call general eschatology, and it's kind of what we've been talking about so far. A general eschatology is all the issues related to the general flow of history towards its consummation, particularly as those elements in the future are come to be realized. The return of Christ, the resurrection of the dead, the judgment of men, the millennial period, heaven and hell. In other words, in a general sense, we talk about general eschatology. We're talking about all of what is being accomplished down this timeline towards its eventual end in Christ, establishing the final whatever in eternity. Okay, so that's a general eschatology. A general eschatology encompasses all of the human race, all of creation, all of the issues of redemption, all of Christ's work, everything. The divine decree from here to here, beginning to end. Okay, so in a general eschatology, we're dealing with a great deal of the direction of the world. But there's another branch of eschatology that we have to talk about first. You might say, what other branch could there be? That pretty much covered everything. There's a personal eschatology as well. There is an individual eschatology. Okay, so let me put it this way. The world has an eschaton. And so do you. Everybody has an eschaton, okay? There is certainly a flow of history as it's working itself from where it began to where it ended, But there's also a flow of history from where you began and where you end as well. So when we talk about a general eschatology, what we're really talking about is the consummation of all of the individual eschatologies that are taking place in the world, as well as how all they all fit together in the grander scheme of things. Okay, so to talk about eschatology, we have to discuss the eschatological issues related to the individual. Or let me put it this way, how individuals are caught up, yes, that is a pun, how individuals are caught up in the consummation of all things in the present, not in the future, in the present, or in the present in the sense of your lifetime and my lifetime. In that discussion, we need to talk about things like death. We need to talk about the continuation of the soul. Is there a conscious life after death or not? We need to talk about things like the resurrection of the body. In that discussion, things like continuity and discontinuity, what continues, what doesn't continue in the resurrected body versus the physical one that we have now. We would talk about judgment. Judgment is a very personal matter. We are all going to be judged individually, not on some corporate basis, but individually for what we have done. And the discussion of the difference between the righteous and the wicked in terms of that judgment, as the Bible clearly points out. So there's a number of issues related to an individual eschatology. We'll talk about ourselves in this first and then continue into the larger discussion of how it all fits together. And this question arises for a reason. And you remember I asked this as part of our discussion last week. If there is a general eschatology of everything moving to a consummation, how do the dead fit into it? How do those who've already died fit into that eschatology? If Christ is going to come back, but Paul's been dead for 2,000 years, is he involved in some way in that reality? Right? That would be a logical question to ask. Am I going to be involved in it if I die before Christ returns? Okay, to make it more personal. So that's why this particular side of eschatology has to be addressed. We need to ask the question, what about those who have already died? And what about us when we do? So there's a number of things, as I mentioned a moment ago, in this particular category, in this branch of eschatology. We're going to talk then about three in particular. We're going to talk about the doctrine of physical death. We're going to talk about the immortality of the soul. And we're going to talk about the intermediate state. So you'll have to come back to a future class to find out what intermediate state is. Tonight we're going to talk about death. There's no way you can do a theology class without eventually coming around to talking about death. Why? Because we all have an appointment with it. It's a part of the theological reality of the world in which we live. Right? So we have to talk about death. In the Bible, death is discussed in three distinct ways. In the Bible, death is discussed in three distinct ways. In one way, of course, the most obvious way that it's spoken of is in terms of our physical nature, our physical reality. So we call it physical death. The individual person living in a body dies. Okay? Physical death. That's one way the Bible talks about it. But another way that the Bible talks about death is the spiritual death. Spiritual death is the idea of the condition of the soul, the immortal part of man, in relation to God. Death in that case would be the disconnect or the brokenness of relationship between God and man. When Adam sinned, he died. It took 900 years for his body to fall to the ground and return to the dust from which it was formed. But he experienced death immediately. God had told him, on the day you eat of the tree, you shall surely die. And that was not a lie. The relationship that Adam had with God at that moment perished. And what is the greatest evidence we have from the narrative that that was true? That the relationship was broken? What's the greatest example? cast out of the garden, banished from the garden and from the presence of God. And so Adam experienced physical death long after he experienced spiritual death. Okay? But there is a third way that death is spoken of in the Bible. And you might say, those two seem to be the only two I can think of. There is another. And the third type is something which theologians call eternal death, or what we might call the second death. The Bible uses that phrase as well as eternal death. This, in this case, is not just death of the body or death of the soul, but rather the permanent and eternal relationship of the soul to God. The broken relationship of the soul in an eternal state from God. A time in which the nature of the person is cast away from God, quote unquote, because nothing can ever escape from the presence of an omnipresent God, but is cast from the presence of God away from his love, his grace, his mercy to everlasting wrath, judgment. That is referred to as eternal death. We might call it the state of man after judgment, or better, the state of man after condemnation. Okay, so the first kind of death is the physical body itself. The second kind of death is the broken relationship of living humans to God. And then the third is the eternal state of man to God after the judgment. Now, let me just ask this as a question, okay? Put your thinking cap on for a second. Which branch of theology, of all the different ologies that we've spoken of so far, okay, remember, go through the list in your mind, remember all of them we talked about, okay, under which branch is the best branch to discuss the issue of physical death? Or let me rephrase that. Which one is it typically discussed under? Okay, anthropology, okay, typically, yes, but that's probably not the best one to put it under. Which branch of theology is physical death most likely associated with, given the historical narrative I just gave you a moment ago? Okay, I'll rephrase. What caused the death of Adam? Sin. So the doctrine of sin is the most likely place where we would actually discuss the doctrine of death. Physical death is associated with sin. Physical sin. Okay? So physical death is a curse that comes because of sin. So I would ask exactly the same question for spiritual death, and you would give me the exact same answer, because it is under the doctrine of sin that we must encounter the reality of both physical and spiritual death. Okay? It is under eschatology, it is under general eschatology, where we would typically discuss the issue of eternal death, because it is yet future. It is yet to be accomplished when the final judgment has been struck, and Christ has now separated the sheep from the goats and sent the sheep off to paradise and sent the goats off to hell, okay? So we would generally discuss physical and spiritual death in those places. And if you remember from our discussion of pharmacology, we did, in fact, have a brief discussion about death in those, in that place. But this is a much better place to have a larger discussion about it, okay? So we're going to talk primarily here about physical and spiritual death. And we will leave the discussion of eternal death off to our discussion of judgment when we get to general eschatology in the future. Okay? You cool with that? All right. He goes, I don't know. You're the teacher. Okay. All right. So let's talk about physical death and subordinately spiritual death. More about physical death here than spiritual death. Okay. Biblically, let's talk about what is death, physical death, biblically. Give me a definition. Go ahead. Sounds like a trick question. She's over there going, I know what he wants, but it's a trap. Well, okay. All right. You can't use the word to define the word. Okay. Okay, that is the separation of the physical body and the spiritual body. That's one. Okay, that's good. What's another? What's the most simplest one? When I say death, what am I saying? That's it. Okay. It's not a trick question. I'm not wearing a squid head and going, it's a trap. That's right. It's the termination of life in the physical body. Okay. But there is a third definition. It's kind of in the middle between the two, and you probably don't know what it is. So let me give you the three of them. So let's start with the first one. Okay. In the very simplest sense, the Bible speaks of death as simply the termination of life. The body stops living. Okay. The metabolic processes of the body cease. Heart stops beating, lungs stop breathing, brain stops thinking or doing whatever it does, and we die. The cellular activity stops and it's over. Okay. There's no more life in the body. Number of places where that is mentioned, like Matthew 10:28, Luke 12:4. In this case, it's simply a reference to the mortal body falling back to the dust from which it was formed. It is no longer alive. It is now just a thing that used to be alive. Now it's dead. And what happens to it? It decays and returns to the dust of the ground, right? And what do we do with that? We put a bit boxes and bury it in the ground because we know it's going back to the ground anyways. So we send it there in the process. Okay. So biblically speaking, death, first and foremost, is the simple termination of life in the physical body. A second idea, however, in death is a little more subtle. And it's the idea of the loss of living in the physical world. Okay. Now let me explain what I mean by that. It comes like this in places like Matthew 2:20, Mark 3:4, John 12, and Acts 15. It's the idea of threatening or losing one's life, no longer being amongst those living on the earth. My grandmother is dead. Am I talking about her body? I'm talking about her, okay? See the distinction? The subtlety is, it's really talking about a person who is no longer amongst the living. They're amongst the dead. Now, we'll define what that means later, but they're not in this life anymore. So the Bible makes a distinction between just the physical body falling back to the dust of the ground and dying versus a person who is dead. Okay? That's an important distinction from a Christian worldview. So one way is the termination of physical life. The next is to not be amongst the living. The third then, going to what Tim said, is the separation of the body and the soul. Now you notice how these are building, because you start with the physical body falling to the ground. You make the connection then, okay, person X is no longer alive. What has happened to them? All right, so the Bible goes to a third reality, which is that in death, the body and the soul are separated. John 19:30, Acts 7:59, Philippians 1:23, James 2:26. There's a number of ways of saying this. We could say it like this. The mortal separating from the immortal. The body separating from the spirit. And there's other terms that could be used, okay? Reformed theology teaches the idea of a bipartite personhood. I know there are some parts of Christianity that talk about a tripartite nature of human beings. A bipartite nature is the simple idea that there is a body and there is a soul. There is a mortal, there is an immortal. There's a physical, and there's a spiritual. The tripartite world says, well, there's actually three. There's a body and a spirit and a soul. Unfortunately, they've never been able to tell me the distinction between the soul and the spirit. I've never been able to understand the difference. So most Reformed theology simply accepts this idea of a bipartite nature, that you are made up of two distinct parts, a mortal and an immortal. When God took that pile of dust from the ground, when he formed it into the shape of the dust of the ground, he created a physical part of the man, and then he breathed into the man to give him an immortal soul. So he gave him another reality, and he integrated those two things together so that they really cannot be separated, per se. Okay, he made a creature that is both physical and spiritual simultaneously, mortal and immortal simultaneously. Now, of course, we believe that he was originally created immortal physically and immortal spiritually. We'll come back to that thought in a minute. Okay, so the termination of physical life itself, the loss of living in the physical world is death, person X is dead, and the separation of the body and the soul are the three different ways that the Bible speaks of death. What it does not ever say is that death is the cessation of existence. Okay? What the Bible never says is that death is the cessation of existence, as though the individual simply does not exist. Rather, it treats death as a severance of the natural relations of life. Okay? A severance of the natural relations of life. Remember a moment ago I used this illustration of God taking this pile of dirt, breathing into it, and creating a being in which the mortal and the immortal are so intertwined that you really can't tell where one leaves off and the other begins. I mean, where does the immortal stop and the mortal begin, and vice versa? Scientists are always trying to figure this out, right? Trying to figure out a way to, you know, take our thoughts and whatever and map them onto some AI computer and move us over there. They'll never succeed at it. Because the reality is that we as creatures are made in such an intrinsic way, mortal and immortal, physical and non-physical, that it's impossible to tell where one lets off and the other begins. I mean, you know this is true. I've used this illustration 1,000 times. Have you ever noticed how a paper cut can ruin your day? Because you get a little cut on your finger, and it bothers you all day long, and it nags at you, and it, you know, and if, imagine it's worse than a paper cut. Imagine it's, you know, a gunshot wound. Okay, that changes your entire understanding of your existence, right? How do you tell where the mortal lets off and the immortal lets off? I mean, okay, I could just come to you and say, look, I know you have a bullet wound in your side, but I just want you to just forget it's there, because as a spiritual creature, you could just ignore it, right? Can you? Not a chance. Because there's a connection between the mortal and the immortal that's inseparable. And that's an important reality. Death itself, then, by definition, cannot be the cessation of existence. Here's the problem that we have. Here's the problem we have. We inherently understand ourselves. We talked about this back in anthropology, but let me repeat it. We understand ourselves to be more than the sum of our parts. We cannot explain ourselves in terms of a clear distinction between who we are as a person and what we are as a thing walking around. You can't make that distinction. I mean, close your eyes and try to imagine you don't exist. Go ahead. You won't succeed. Okay, imagine you simply don't exist. You can't do it. Because we inherently understand we are more than just physical things walking around that suddenly disappear at the moment of death. I mean, we even use language like, we even betray this. Even our evolutionist friends betray themselves. Well, my mother is dead. Wait a minute. She's your mother? Or she was your mother? Well, yeah, but she was just a pile of, you know, dust walking around, but she's not my mother anymore. She's gone. But you still think about her. You can't escape from this. You keep going there. That's the point. The Bible uses this middle term, this idea of not being among the living anymore, because this is the reality the Bible thinks about us. As bipartite creatures, we do not just evaporate into non-existence. Now, I realize our evolutionary friends want us to believe that. Now, you know why, don't you? Do you know why our evolutionary friends want us to believe that we simply blink out of existence? Want to take a guess? Okay, well, that's not just there's no God. But look, if we are just creatures that are really not sentient beings as we claim to be, and there is nothing beyond this mortal life, then we are free to rob and steal and cheat and have adulterous affairs with anybody we want to, because there's nothing beyond this life. That's the reason why they want you to believe that, because they want permission to go and live whatever way they want to. Okay, that's the whole idea. So, that's a problem. Death is also not, from a biblical perspective, an opposite of life, but a change into a different mode of existence. What's fascinating is what Jesus himself said. He said, I am, before Abraham was, I am. Okay? Now, that in of itself is not all that fascinating, but he said, God is the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Isn't that interesting? Jesus himself said he's the God of Abraham. And if you read the Greek in that text, he's using present tense verbs. God is not the God of the man who was Abraham. He is the God of the man who is Abraham. So even Jesus is saying, listen, there's a reality about Abraham. Abraham died 2,000 years ago from your perspective, 4,000 years ago is from ours. But from the reality of the human experience, he is still Abraham. So it's a change, biblically, in mode of existence, rather than just succession. So it's not the succession of life per se. Again, for life is more than our physical existence. In fact, the question that we have to ask ourselves is not what is death, but the real question we have to ask is what is life? What does it mean to be alive? As a human, okay? Not as an animal, but as a human. What does it mean to be alive? There's life in you, but that life is more than just you acting in ways that are instinctive. You are building experiences and memories and you are having complex thoughts and developing all kinds of things in your existence which are beyond you just being a pile of dirt. Right? So, if we're just a pile of dirt, then how do we explain all of those complex concepts? And what happens to those complex concepts when we disappear? When we die. Right? Okay. So the Bible doesn't call it a succession of existence, but a severance of the natural relations of life. The natural relations of life would be a body and a soul put together by God into a being. That's what makes you unique. That's what we call the image of God. So it's a change in that relationship. A change in that relationship. It's a break in the vital relation in which man, as created in the image of God, stands to his maker. It's a change in the vital relation in which man, as created in the image of God, stands to his maker. The loss of that image, and consequently a disturbing of all the relations of life itself. That's Burkhoff's statement. When God created man, did he expect that man to walk and talk and think and discover and create and Of course he did. He created him to do that. He gave him image to do that. Death changes the ability of the man to do that. But does it change inherently the man? It changes the relationship, changes the relation, but it cannot change the man from a biblical point of view. Okay? We might put it this way. Death is the enemy of the good that God had established in creating man in his own image. This is the word I like. It's an enemy. Death is an enemy of all that God purposed to create in man. Which is the reason why the devil came as he did. Because as the enemy of God, he attempted to make an enemy into man. He succeeded. By man falling into sin. It becomes the enemy, which has to be overcome. I mean, doesn't the Bible speak about Christ having victory over death? Isn't that the language of an enemy being conquered? Is the idea. So it's an enemy. Death is not a wonderful thing. No, from a biblical worldview, death is the enemy. It is the violation, a breaking of the intimate connection between the physical and the spiritual. As creatures that are formed as both physical and spiritual, death unnaturally separates the mortal from the immortal. Unnaturally separates those two things, in contrast to what God had purposed within us at our initial formation. Make no mistake about it. We do not celebrate death. Because death is the enemy. It is exactly the opposite of what God had originally intended in forming the dust of the ground and breathing into it, into making a living being. It is an enemy. It is an enemy of all that God called good. You understand that, right? Now, we live, of course, in a culture of death. And we live in a time in which death itself is celebrated. We now have actresses who stand in front of the world and claim that the reason that they're famous is because they killed their children. Okay, so we celebrate death. We live in a culture in which death is considered to be normal and acceptable and something to be celebrated. But it is not. From a biblical worldview, death is the enemy. All right, I want you to think about that and get that fixed in your mind. Because frankly, if you think that death is something to be celebrated, then you probably don't have a very good hamartiology. Now, let's make a connection between sin and death. Let's make a connection between sin and death. This is logical, but let's make sure we go there. Question. Was there physical death in the world prior to Adam? No? You say no? Okay. What do you say? You say no? You say no? Okay. Or more specifically, if I might change the question slightly, was Adam himself subject to death in the garden? And the curse, simply God leaving Adam in his natural state? Or more specifically, was Adam himself subject to death, meaning that he was going to die when he was created, but the curse was simply God leaving him in that state to continue towards the path, on the path towards death? Now, you're looking at me with this scrunched up eyebrows and wondering, why are you asking this question? Go ahead. Okay, I would agree. That's an that is a very good, you will die, future tense.
You're gonna die anyway.
Right.
You're
correct.
Dead, you're gonna,
yeah.
You will die.
Right. Okay.
Inference being, you'll live if you don't do that.
The reason I bring this up is because there's a whole lot of Christians now in modern evangelicalism that are attempting to square the circle. And the circle is this, the square is this. Things die everywhere all the time. And it seems as though they've been dying for centuries, going all the way back as far as we can find record for it. And secondly, the very systems that in which we live have within them the very essence of decay and death. It cannot be escaped. And so what a lot of evangelicals are attempting to do is square this circle. How do we explain the idea that there was a time in which there was no death in the world? No plant died, no animal died, no bird died, no insect died, nothing died, and then all of a sudden everything began to die. Doesn't make sense to a lot of folks. Well, yeah, but they do believe in sin, but they're trying to get around this idea that, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, because look, evangelicals have been deeply affected by evolutionary theory, because guess what? You've had three generations of people being raised in it, okay? So you have these evangelicals who are going, how do we square that circle? There couldn't have been a time when there was no death in the world, because the world has always got death in it. So we've got to say that, well, here's what, and there are some theologians now who are making the case that what actually happened was that Adam was created in a state in which he, like everything else around him, was subject to death. But he could have developed his own immortality if he had consistently eaten from the tree of life for the rest of his life. And not been banished from the garden away from the tree of life after he had sinned. The real curse wasn't that he was going to fall back to the ground. That was already in place. But the real problem is that he was going to be banished from the tree of life, thus he would not be able to attain his own immortality. And so after 900 years, he finally fell over dead. See what they're trying to do? Now, how to explain that? Now, again, as I said, this position is the default amongst even evolutionists, because in the death is intrinsic in closed systems. Decay, destruction, entropy is an inherent part of closed systems, right? So this position is there. And by the way, it has had its own place in church history. There was a guy by the name of Pelagius who argued with Augustine about the issue of original sin. Pelagius argued that man was created in a state in which he could attain his own righteousness. He did not inherit the sin of Adam. Rather, he was born, all men are born in a state of innocence, and they can, of themselves, produce their own righteousness by virtue of keeping the law and doing all. And the basic argument that Pelagius used was this. Look, if God commands something, it must be possible to do. If God commands you to be righteous, it must be possible. So Pelagius took the position that there was no such thing as original sin. Well, the idea behind that is that God had granted Adam the ability to attain immortality through obedience, just as we can obtain righteousness through our own effort. Right? So it's not a position that has never been part of the church. There have been people who have been attempting to make this point, because it's simply, for most people living today, modern people, it's absurd that there was a time in which there was no death in the world. No animals eating other animals, no insects ever dying. That doesn't make any sense. They're trying to square the circle. So the answer to the question is a big fat no, okay, with an exclamation point. Was there death in the world prior to Adam? The answer is no, there was not, all right? Because, and here's why, and you alluded to it, the Bible always treats death as penal, a punishment. The Bible always treats death as a punishment. Death, biblically, is the immutable consequence of sin. Death is the immutable consequence of sin itself. Adam was created immortal, but was cursed with the punishment of death for his disobedience. All of creation was cursed alongside him for his disobedience, with death entering the created order as a result of his sin. I would have you to compare Romans 5, verse 12, with some verses in Romans 8. Paul says, "For as sin entered the world through one man, and through sin came death, thus death spread to all men," and he makes a whole argument in the middle of Romans 5 about original sin as a consequence. In other words, a proper view of what Adam did, or what we talked about some time back in harmartiology, is that a proper view of original sin teaches that human death is the result of his sin. Not our sin, his sin. The problem, of course, is that the vast majority of evangelicals and Protestants don't believe that anymore. They believe in the idea that I am only culpable for what I have done. I cannot be held culpable for what somebody else did. But the Bible is clear. Death entered the world through one man. That one man's sin brought death into the world, and you die no matter how well you keep the law. Even if you were able to, from the moment of your birth to the moment of your death, keep the law perfectly, you would still die. There's no way you can avoid this reality. And we all know this to be the case. I would argue, by the way, this is just my own opinion, but I would argue that the semi-Pelagian theology that's rampant today in the church, which is enhanced by the culture of death, means that many Christians deny this doctrine of original sin and ignore the reality of death within their theological framework. I'll give you an example. I read an article today, just today, of all things, on how there are so many Christians now who have decided not to have funerals, but rather to have celebrations of life. Okay? So we've changed the whole process of dying now that we don't actually do funerals anymore, where we actually speak of the gospel and what death means and what death is all about. Rather, we just get together, we tell jokes about the deceased person, throw them in the ground, and go on about our merry way. In other words, in many parts of evangelicalism, death itself is being ignored. But that makes sense inside of a culture of death, in which death is just sort of considered normal, right? What do you do? Well, who cares? Somebody's died? Whatever. Let's go celebrate their life. Now, let's think about this reality. What if there was death prior to Adam? Okay, not only is it considered penal in every way, but let me make a couple of other arguments. To assume that death preexisted Adam is to say that God was not capable of continuing man and the whole world in a state of immortality by virtue of his creative and sustaining power. Right? And it's basically saying, well, yeah, God could have created a world where there was no, well, I guess he couldn't have, really. Is God capable of creating a world in which there's no death?
Mm-hmm. They're denying God's sovereignty.
Well, they're denying God's power even more than his sovereignty. I mean, okay, so the all-powerful God can only create a world that has death in it? That doesn't make any sense. Okay. Secondly, since man was created in the image of God, with the image of God being a perfect representation of the communicable attributes of God, it is unreasonable to assume that that image contained any sense of decay and mortality within it. Why? Because it comes from God. It doesn't come from the natural world. God breathed into the pile of dust. That was a unique event in which a particular aspect of God himself, or all the particular communicable attributes of God, were breathed into the pile of dust. To assume then that the pile of dust had then within it the spark of death because of the immortality of God put into it doesn't make any sense. That would basically be to say the same thing as I said a moment ago. So God's not capable of breathing into a creature so he lives forever? Next, in the Bible, physical death is represented as the result of spiritual death, not the other way around. Physical death is the result of spiritual death. The brokenness of the relationship between God and Adam, including his banishment, then causes Adam's physical body to fall back to the dust. It's always treated in that way. It's not treated the other way around. Therefore, when we consider Adam in his state, his spiritual death is what produced his physical death. So he was, by definition, immortal until he chose to die spiritually. Thus, his physical body eventually decayed and fell away. Fifthly, in the Bible, death is never treated as normal for man, as I said a moment ago. Rather, it's treated as an enemy, as something utterly foreign and hostile to human life. For example, it is treated as an expression of divine anger. Psalm 90, verses 7 and 11. God becomes angry and strikes men dead. It is treated as a judgment in Romans 1, verse 32. It's treated as a condemnation in Romans 5, verse 16. It's treated as a curse in Galatians 3, 13. Death fills the heart with dread and fear. Why? Because it is unnatural. If it were natural, we would not fear it. But because it's unnatural, we fear it. We extend that backwards then to Adam. Adam had no fear of such a thing. There was no judgment. There was no condemnation. There was nothing that God would curse down upon him. Therefore, logically going, there would be no death. Death itself, even in the Bible, an additional argument, is that death in the Bible is limited by the power of God. True or false? God could have physically killed Adam at the moment that he ate from the tree. True. Should he have? No. Sorry, no. Why not? Because his plan as God was to, through the progeny of Adam, to bring a savior of men into the world. So no, he should not have killed Adam immediately. Okay? It's kind of a trick question, right? Because your first reaction is, yes, he should have just killed him right there. No, not exactly. Death is limited by the power of God. God has the power to destroy any of us instantaneously with death if he so chooses. Simply lifts his hand from us and we fall back to the ground, right? But God has limited his power. He has also restrained death in the world by his common grace. I mean, there's a lot of things, for example, that give us an ability to overcome physical death, right? We have immune systems. We create medicines, develop all kinds of protections. Right? I mean, you right in that profession. Look at how many things we can have which help us to avert death. We can't eliminate it, but we can postpone it as long as God, this is all part of the common grace of God. He allows us to restrain death even, okay? And we know that death is overcome by the special grace wrought in Christ Jesus as he conquered this hostile force. The Son of God experienced death himself, right? He rose to overcome it. So there's multiple aspects. It's limited by the by the divine grace of God. It is restrained by the common grace of God. And it is overcome by the special grace of God. God has chosen, remember my definition of grace, God has chosen not to kill the human race just because they sin. He has chosen to allow us to avert death. And he has chosen to overcome the power of death through his own incarnation and execution. So God, in a sense, is using death to accomplish a greater purpose. Now, we don't often look at it like that, but that's exactly what he's doing. He's using death, even in our experience, to a greater good. A point we'll come back to, Lord willing, next week, because we're out of time. But the fact is that the Bible treats death as a penal reality. This separation, this enemy, has been cursed into the world because of sin. But, nonetheless, God is using that reality to accomplish something greater. Now, we're gonna ask another more personal question related to that as we come back, Lord, next week, Lord willing. And I want you to, so I'm gonna give you the question. I'm gonna let you go home and think about it for a week, okay? If the wages of sin is death, Romans 6:23, but believers stand justified before God by faith in the one who overcame the power of death, why do we, as believers, still die? Why do we still die? So I'll let you go home and think about that, and we'll come back next week, and we'll struggle with that particular question. Because it seems problematic, doesn't it? If the one who overcame death has overcome it, why do we who put our faith in him still have to experience it?